We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. All right, plenty to cover. Starting with an update on the tunnel measure that was.
Yes, the court judge in the case came up with the wording for the tunnel measure, and the wording that voters are going to be voting on, and I'm just going to read the two sentences here. Is the city council is authorized to decide whether to issue the notice referenced in section 2.3 of each agreement. That decision shall be made at an open public meeting held after issuance of the final environmental impact statement. And then the measure asks voters to either approve that or reject that. And there's been much debate over what that means. Some of the folks who are supporting the tunnel say, well, that doesn't mean anything. And folks who are against the tunnel say, well, you're kidding, right? That means that voters are going to be voting whether to reject the council's authority to finalize the agreements. Essentially, it's a vote on whether the tunnel should go forward or not. However, State Transportation Secretary Paula Hammond weighed in on this, telling everybody what she thinks it means. And she said that the state is going to go ahead with the tunnel regardless of the outcome of the vote. And that it doesn't matter whether the city signs these agreements, that the state can override whatever happens in city government. Basically, she listed the people that matter when it comes to the tunnel, the folks who want it to go ahead, which include the governor, the King County Executive, the City Council, and the downtown Seattle business community represented by the Chamber of Commerce. Apparently, some Seattle residents are more equal, and their opinions outweigh any vote by the city's voters.
So who exactly elected the Seattle Chamber of Commerce? did I miss something there?
They elected themselves.
It's the Downtown Business Association.
Well, we'll
self-starters.
We'll get to that when we talk about a national court decision on some campaign contributors being more equal than others too. But mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. You're right.
All right, moving on. The city of Seattle has been told to stop naming SPD officers.
Yeah, on Wednesday, a decision that was made earlier in the month by a labor arbitrator in a dispute between the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the city ruled that the city would have to stop naming the SPD officers who are being disciplined by the SPD for engaging in suspect conduct. It turns out that in a 2008 contract signed by the Police Officers Guild that governs the release of records sought by the news media, that there's some language that was in dispute, and the labor arbitrator ruled that, well, despite public disclosure laws, that the contract that represents the police officers guild that represents police officers, that labor contract prevents the city from releasing the names of officers who are undergoing disciplinary action. Of course, that totally undermines any kind of sense that the police actually work for the public and that public disclosure laws should be taken seriously.
How is it that a labor contract can trump law?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Wouldn't that make the contract illegal rather than giving the contract itself preeminence?
You would think, and you would think people would be asking, okay, who are the idiots who put forth this contract and negotiated it?
It was approved by city council.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, isn't the city you might have just mentioned this, negotiating with the guild for the next contract?
Yeah.
Yes, it's already started. That's correct.
Yes, so. That's correct.
All right, moving on. The state budget, and just finally.
Yeah, literally at the very last minute of the extended special session, the legislature came forward and approved a state budget. Now, when you look at the state budget, you can see that the bulk of it is devoted to funding education. And most folks ask themselves, well, geez, you know, at least I ask myself, geez, you know, if you want the state to do anything, it's to fund education. I mean, it's enshrined in the state constitution that the state provide all of the children and young folks in the state public education. Well, it turns out that 50% of all of the cuts in the $4 billion in cuts in this new budget are going to hit education. Excuse me. And keep in mind that this is a budget with no new revenue, and it's not closing any tax loopholes. The pay for K through 12 teachers will be cut by almost 2%. School administrative staff will see a 3% pay cut. It suspends two voter initiatives dealing with teacher pay and class size reductions. It cuts money for class size reductions for K through 4 grades. There are cuts to higher education, about $500 million in cuts to academic services to universities and colleges in the state. $87 million in salary cuts for higher education, and universities, four-year universities and colleges will be allowed to raise tuition by double digits, by at least 16%. This is after being given the ability by the legislature earlier on to raise tuition however high they want. Technical schools and two-year community colleges will also be able to raise tuition by at least 12% per year for the next 2 years. In addition, those were the education cuts, but there were a lot of other cuts too, mostly to the other services you expect from the state government. State government often steps in and provides and plugs holes in the social safety net that the federal government has not covered. In this case, the state budget is eliminating a lot of that safety net by eliminating cost of living increases for retired state workers. It eliminates Disability Lifeline for the state's disabled and completely unemployable population. It's freezing new enrollments to the basic health care plan. Keep in mind that enrollees in the basic health care plan have to pay a portion of their costs. That's, you know, due to prior cuts to the basic health plan. Now there will be no new enrollees, and the basic health plan just survived by the skin of its teeth this time. And there will be deep cuts to dental care, pregnancy care, and community clinics for the poor and uninsured. So really, this was a budget that was balanced on the backs of children and on the most vulnerable people in our population.
All right. And related to that, a vote this week in Olympia?
Yeah, the Democrats in the State House of Representatives took a vote this week trying to raise revenue to help supplement the budget. They knew that the vote was going to fail. It actually passed by a vote of 52-42 to close some of the bank loopholes in the tax code, tax breaks for out-of-state banks. It needed to pass by a two-thirds majority due to I-1053. And it was a straight party-line vote. 52 Democrats voted for it, 42 Republicans voted against it. But the reasons the Democrat took the vote, knowing that it was going to fail, and were very careful about the procedures that they followed in calling and taking the vote, was that they were going to use that vote as a court challenge on the constitutionality of I-1053, saying that a supermajority in order to pass revenues but not to pass budget cuts is unconstitutional, and that the two-thirds requirement prevents the state from fulfilling its constitutional obligation to adequately fund education which is a constitutional requirement under the Washington State Constitution. Now,
so some good news coming.
Yes,
out of
well, it's somewhat good news. Now, why the Democrats didn't take that vote the first thing in the regular session last January, rather than waiting until the last days of the special session when a budget agreement was about to be hammered out, is another question. Because if they had done it early on, it might have at least gotten through some initial court rulings and influenced the budget negotiations for this year. But nonetheless, it might lay the groundwork for not hamstringing the state quite as much when it comes to the unavoidable, because they're structurally hardwired in, the unavoidable budget deficits that are going to continue to plague the state unless and until we have meaningful tax reform.
Mm-hmm. All right. That moves us on then to nationals, starting with Chicago.
Yeah, there's a trial going on in Chicago of a Chicago businessman, Pakistani-American, suspected of supporting the 2008 attack on Mumbai, India. If you remember back to 2008 when gunmen literally invaded Mumbai, India, hotels and public spaces there, took hostages and killed a large number of people. That was a very serious attack, and there were murmurings at the time that these gunmen were not just Islamic militants, but they were trained and armed in Pakistan, and that there may have been some connection with the Pakistani intelligence services. Well, we're starting to get a lot more information about that attack through this trial. Now, the trial is of Tahawar Rana is the name of the defendant. He's being sued by the U.S. government. And the U.S. government's leading witness in the case is a man named David C. Headley. Headley has been testifying in the case all this week. In his testimony, it came out that he's been working for the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, since at least 1999. And that was about the same time that he was smuggling heroin from Pakistan into the United States.
Wait a minute. Somebody smuggling heroin is working for the DEA?
Yes, the DEA was paying him as an informant. Now, the DEA asked him, put it in his mind, to travel to Pakistan to infiltrate radical Islamic groups there, in particular Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that has been linked to the attack on Mumbai. Now, while Headley was in Pakistan, he started training with Lashkar-e-Taiba between 2002 and 2005. And during that time, he offered to scout locations in India for the group to attack. In other words, he's the guy who went to India, did the surveillance, and helped to scout out the sites that were part of the Mumbai attack. In 2006, Headley admitted he met a man named Major Iqbal, who was a member of Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, who was so impressed with his work with Lashkar-e-Taiba that he offered financial support to Headley and the group, Lashkar, so that they could continue their search for targets in India. Headley admitted that he had provided hours and hours of video footage of potential targets to both Lashkar-e-Taiba and to the ISI simultaneously. This is a guy who was working for the DEA, working for Pakistani intelligence, working for Lashkar-e-Taiba, probably taking money from all three. And remember, initially, he was a DEA informant recruited by the U.S. government to help to infiltrate this Muslim fundamentalist group, whom he helped in major ways to set up and stage the attacks in Mumbai, India, and at the same time he brought Pakistani intelligence on board. This is the kind of guy that the U.S. government looks for as an informant, and it really points out to the major problem with the war on terror and with the new and expanding powers under the Patriot Act that allow government agencies to recruit informants and to essentially help set up and help stage what are terrorist attacks.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Headley's not being indicted, but we did have another terrible, terrible threat to the national security, who was arrested by FBI and SWAT teams last week. He's a longtime Chicano peace activist named Carlos Montes of Los Angeles, and he was raided by FBI and SWAT teams and accused of aiding terrorist organizations. Very similar, if you remember, to the peace activists in Chicago and Minneapolis who were raided and like Montes, had their computers seized and various other, basically everything that they owned that was related to their activism scene. Well, this happened to Montes last week in Los Angeles also. However, he's only being charged with a firearm code violation, because frankly that's all they can find. Well, what's Montes's major political activity these days? He's among the people who have been active in Southern California in protesting the FBI's raid on the activists in Chicago and Minneapolis. So it really points up that a lot of the war on terror rhetoric that's being used to justify these sorts of raids is actually in practice being used in some of these cases in order to target critics of the government, critics of the Obama administration, critics of Patriot Act and war on terror tactics. And similar to that, we had a last-minute extension of the Patriot Act this week by President Obama, who had to sign it from France because Rand Paul, the libertarian from Kentucky, held up passage of the extension in the Senate until the very last minute. Obama extending the Patriot Act minutes before its expiration with no real new checks on any of the Patriot Act's authorities, and a couple of different senators, including Ron Wyden from Oregon, who sit on the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying, of course, and of course they're prohibited by law by discussing what they know about how these acts are being interpreted and used by the federal government. But basically what Wyden was saying, if the American people only knew what the government was doing with these powers, they would be up in arms. They would be outraged.
Apparently the government's interpretation of the Patriot Act law is also classified, so we can't have access to how the Justice Department advises its employees. That's members of the FBI and other members of government law enforcement agencies on how to actually use the Patriot Act. That's all considered classified. And Wyden was saying if the American public knew how broadly they're interpreting their Patriot Act powers, we would be extremely upset.
All right. Moving on, unless you have anything else to add on that?
No, let's keep going.
Let's move on.
There's a lot more here.
Yeah, and Congress is fairly busy this week, starting with the Republicans.
Yeah, Republicans led by Senate Majority Leader, Minority Leader rather, Mitch McConnell, saying that the Republicans will block the extension of or the expansion of the debt ceiling, which is coming up really in the next week or so, unless Democrats agree to trash Medicare. Now, if the debt ceiling is not expanded to accommodate the U.S. being able to pay in. Pay on its debts, that's going to have all kinds of implications for the financial markets and for the economy. So the Republicans essentially holding that hostage in a terrorist act in order to demand that the Democrats essentially gut Medicare, similar to what Paul Ryan has proposed in his budget. Even though the Republicans lost a special election in upstate New York this past week, basically on that very topic, which was hammered by the Democratic opponent in a heavily Republican district. Meanwhile, the House voted 215 to 204 this week against a plan to immediately leave Afghanistan. Now, the notable thing about that was how close it was. 178 of the 186 Democrats voted to leave at Afghanistan, essentially voting 178 to 8 against their own president, and 26 Republicans agreed. That was very close to a House majority saying that the war in Afghanistan doesn't make sense. It's a problem. It's a waste of money. It needs to end. That's some real momentum for trying to end the war. The flip side of that is the Republicans in the House also passed legislation this past week, which thankfully will not get any kind of a hearing in the Senate, that essentially would bar basic health care for women. It barred the teaching in health centers that receive federal funds under the new Health Care Act. It barred those health centers from using the money to teach, quote, abortion techniques. Now, the problem with that language is that abortion techniques like a DNC are also very basic to a number of other conditions for women, particularly miscarriages, but also any number of other other issues.
Anything if you bear a child and you have problems clearing the placenta from your womb, you need a DNC. You know, to save your life, essentially, because if you don't clear the placenta, you die of an infection. That used to be a very common problem with women dying from childbirth, infections after the baby is born. You use it for all kinds of basic medical reasons, everything from dealing with benign tumors to heavy menstrual bleeding. I would say a very large proportion of adult women these days have had at least one DNC in their lifetime. Barring any kind of technique that might be used for abortion is, as Jobs said, essentially saying that women's reproductive health care would be illegal.
Yeah. And again, thank your friendly local Republican Party for that. Keep electing these people. That's exactly the kind of laws you're going to have in this country that make health care for women illegal. It's really very, very frightening stuff.
All right. Well, sticking with the subject of frightening, a couple court rulings this week.
Yeah, a Reagan appointee who's a federal district judge in Virginia built on Citizens United this week by ruling that corporations can give directly to candidates for elected office. Now, that's a stricture that essentially prevents, say, Campbell's Soup from giving money directly to Christine Gregoire for a re-election campaign, to pick a completely random example. The problem with that, of course, is that there's nothing to prevent a large corporation to incorporate thousands of times to give different, to have different quote-unquote different corporations or sub-corporations from giving money to electoral candidates. In other words, it's a complete end-around around campaign contribution limits by corporations. So that,
yes, well, and many major corporations own smaller companies under the big parent umbrella, so each small company could give up to the campaign limit.
And above and beyond that, if you incorporate somewhere other than the United States, you would also have a really hard time finding out who the individuals or the companies are who are behind these subcorporations. So it's essentially a complete evisceration of campaign finance law, and something that's likely to go to the conservative Supreme Court. In which case, we're in a great deal of trouble.
We know how that's gonna turn out.
Meanwhile, another Supreme Court ruling this week. Actually was a surprising ruling, and surprisingly good ruling, that California prisons are de facto cruel and unusual punishment due to overcrowding. The suit was brought on behalf of inmates who were ill, who were claiming that they couldn't get suitable treatment for their medical conditions because of overcrowding. And the Supreme Court ruled essentially, look, the only way that medical care can be given to these employees is if the overall population of the jails and prisons is reduced. Now, some very revealing rhetoric in the wake of this ruling. One California official saying that we can comply with this without releasing any criminals. That isn't exactly what he meant. My first thought with that was, well, given that the war on drugs has imprisoned an awful lot of people who aren't criminals, that would be very hard. But what he really meant was by transferring them to county jails and other non-state prisons instead. But there's no money for that even. Yet the Republicans in California who have caused a lot of this problem to begin with, through that state's budget problems, are saying, well, we just need to build new prisons. Of course, there's no money for that either.
All right, let's move on to international, starting with Spain.
Yeah, for the past week and a half or so, the Real Democracy Now movement has sprung up, occupying plazas and city centers around all the major cities of Spain in response to that country's austerity measures, which, of course, we've been talking about in various European countries for the last several months. Well, that's happened in Spain over the past couple of months, and this movement is the first time that we've seen the first time in Europe that we've seen protests very much modeled on and taking inspiration from the Arab Spring. We've also seen conflicts with Spanish police on some of those demonstrations. And something that particularly caught my eye, that one of the demands and concerns of the Spanish protesters, of course, this is a parliamentary system that we're talking about in Spain, is that they're claiming that real democracy is not possible in Spain because the political system there is increasingly limited to only two major political parties.
That's interesting. You know, the economic conditions in Spain are very bad right now. Unemployment is well over 20%. Here in the U.S., official unemployment is about 9 to 10%, with unofficial employment probably getting close to 20%. And yet here we have a much bigger response in Spain than we do here. And as Job said, in Spain, they're saying we don't have a representative democracy with only two parties. That's very interesting to me.
All right. Couple.
And it has some possible local, you know, domestic corollaries.
You would think so.
A couple climate change studies that came out?
Yeah. One that was a study by the National Science Foundation and Department of Energy, looking at 13 Midwestern plants that provide a lot of ground cover and their capacity to absorb carbon dioxide when carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are increased. It turns out that their ability to absorb CO2 decreases much more quickly than expected with higher CO2 levels in the atmosphere. The conclusion of that, of course, is that as the CO2 levels in the atmosphere raise, that current climate change modeling predictions of the rate of climate change have vastly understated the ability of CO2 to accumulate in the atmosphere because they were making assumptions about plant cover's ability to absorb some of it. They're just not accurate. There's just simply not enough capacity.
That's yet another study that shows an aspect of acceleration for global climate change. And we're seeing that in study after study, that when they're looking at what, you know, when they're reviewing what do we think the rate of global climate change or global warming is going to be, they're finding these things that point to an acceleration effect.
And you had a second study also?
Yeah, there was a study by Oxfam done of weather-related disasters, particularly in poorer nations since 1980. Over the last 30 years, it turns out that weather-related disasters have increased by tripled in these poorer nations. And mostly they looked at precipitation-related weather disasters like monsoons and flooding, and that you don't see a big increase in basically all natural disasters, like, for example, earthquakes and volcano eruptions. Those tend to be steady over time. But if you look at the data since 1980, there's been a tripling of weather-related incidents regarding anything involved with more precipitation being in the atmosphere, and that's exactly what you would expect in a world that is warming.
All right. Yemen.
Yemen. Yeah, this week Ali Abdullah Saleh, the leader of Yemen, has for the third time refused to sign an agreement to give up power within 30 days in exchange for immunity from prosecution for corruption and for the killing of protesters. This was after his armed supporters surrounded the embassy where the signing of the agreement was supposed to take place so that the signing could not take place. Diplomats had to leave the embassy by helicopter to go to the presidential palace where they urged him to sign the agreement, and he backed out at the last minute. His supporters then surrounded the compound of a rival leader, of a rival opposition member, a leader of another large tribe in Yemen, and they began attacking the compound. This led to armed fighting in the capital, including the shelling of some 9 different ministry buildings, the Sabah news building, and the headquarters of the National Airline, which was set on fire. The fighting spread to the airport and has spread to cities around the country. I'd like to point out that many provinces in Yemen have fallen completely outside of the control of the central government, and it now appears that Yemen is on the verge of civil war. This is, and I'd also like to point out too that the peaceful protesters in the streets of the capital of Sana'a are not related at all to the tribes that are fighting. This is strictly a civil war that has broken out between Saleh and his rivals, and the people of Yemen are caught in the middle.
All right. And finally, Egypt.
Yeah, some good news coming out of Egypt. Egypt announced this week that it would open the border with the Gaza Strip today, that the Palestinian Hamas run Palestinian Authority in the Gaza Strip will no longer be isolated by an international blockade. The Egyptian government will allow people through the Rafah border crossing beginning today. That's some good news. At the same time, President Hosni Mubarak is going on trial for corruption and for the killing of demonstrators in Tahrir Square in Egypt. And that's exactly the kind of thing I'm sure that the leaders of Yemen and Bahrain and Syria are fearing, that if they give up power, they will also be put on trial the same way Mubarak is.
All right. If you can do it in about 40 seconds, Libya.
Libya, yeah, there's some news coming out of Libya this week. You won't find it in the U.S. press. You have to go to the European press, that the Libyan government is asking for a peace agreement with NATO. They are willing to start talking about a change of government in Libya if NATO ends its bombing campaign. Of course, again, you're not going to see that in the U.S. press, it's going to be buried in the back pages. But it's a major move and could end the confrontation in Libya if the NATO powers take it seriously.
Yeah, and one of the other potential routes, Russia has now agreed to mediate. They had been opposed to the NATO intervention, and then now they're agreeing also to mediate Gaddafi's removal from power.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Events.
Folk Life is well underway this weekend at Seattle Center, Center International Film Festival, also continuing. And then on Wednesday, June 1st, Yes Magazine, our good friends over there, are celebrating their 15th anniversary, and they've got a great lineup at Town Hall on Wednesday night. Bill McKibben, Vandana Shiva, and Van Jones. Tickets are $25, $15 for Yes subscribers, and that's 7 o'clock Wednesday night at Town Hall.
Wow, stellar lineup. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, local and national and international news, opinion, tips, comics, all that kind of good stuff.